Worry, anxiety, and stress. These are things that a faithful Christian often longs to get rid of in their lives and eliminate altogether when they put all their faith in God and follow Christ in every way. We know these things aren't good for us, worrying too much about things that are going on in the world. We know this because the Bible tells us this many places. In Philippians 4, we just were. Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your request to God. Matthew 6, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink. Do not worry about tomorrow. Luke 12, I tell you, do not worry about your life. Ecclesiastes 11, so then banish anxiety from your heart. We know these things aren't good for us, but sometimes the world and its pressures can creep into our lives and cause us to worry about things that we shouldn't. We know that this past year has given us plenty to worry about. There's many things in this world that could give us worry and anxiety. Our job, money, our homes, our health, the pandemic. All these things can cause stress in our lives. And why is it that people get worried? People get anxious. I think one of the reasons is because God put us on this planet essentially blind. All we are given is the present. We live second by second, never knowing what the next moment's going to bring. Nobody knows. No one knows what's going to happen 10 years from now, 5 years from now, next year, next month, next week, tomorrow, not even in the next 5 minutes. Nobody knows. Now, we can guess. We oftentimes make educated guesses and assumptions based on our past. Like we could say, well, most likely, we're going to finish this Sunday service. We're going to get together and get to know each other a little bit better. We're going to go eat lunch. And most likely, everything is going to be fine. Because that's what's happened in the past. But nobody knows what's going to happen. And that's why we as humans, people who don't put their faith in God, often sink so much time, so much money and resources in training people, analysts who pore over data, looking over the past. They build these big computers, powerful number crunchers, looking for any patterns, any kind of hint or clue that will give them some kind of indication of what's going to happen in the future. Because that's where a lot of people's security lies. Is in what is going to happen to me? And how they can be prepared for it. And that's one of the reasons why insurance is so popular. Right? People sink a lot of money. It's a big business, insurances. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. These are only the main categories. I was trying to look up and get a definitive number, but each one of these categories has a plethora of subcategories and categories beneath them that people that accommodate almost everyone in every possible situation to give people some kind of insurance and security that whatever happens, they'll be taken care of instead of putting their faith in God. But I'm not saying that having insurance is a sin. I don't think it's bad because, you know, I have insurance. But I think there is a big difference between being prudent and being paranoid. You can make a logical decision based on the information that you're given and being a good steward about what God has given you, or it can stress you out and worry about what's going to happen and panic about it, which is not healthy, and that's not what God has told us to do. But there's so when I get like this, sometimes the world can put pressures on me, and I hear the news and I worry about, oh, is there going to be a drought? Is there going to be water? Is the vaccine going to cause problems? You know, a lot of things get on my mind. And when I feel like this, and anxiety, I feel it creeping in on me, I often look to the Bible. And I look at the miracles of God and how powerful He is and how amazing He is. And that helps reassure me that he is in control and that nothing is going to happen that he can't handle. So what this lesson is going to be about, it's not going to be anything new. Nothing, I'm not going to teach you anything. It's all going to be stories that you've heard before, but it's just a review of the miracles and the power of God to help reassure us about who is in control. Because God did not tell us not to worry without giving us ample proof and overwhelming evidence that he is in control. I also got to give a special thanks to Nathan, because we've been having this discussion and lessons on Mark, and a lot of these ideas have come from the discussion we've been having. It's a class that many of us have been sharing. I hope that somebody will attend. It's on every Friday. But let's look at some of these miracles. Psalm 77, who is the one that does all these wonders and miracles? It's God. You are the God who does wonders. He tells us not to worry, and he tells us how powerful he is through what he does, what he's capable of. The first one, Joshua chapter 10. We all know this story. The Israelites have crossed into the promised land, and they've taken over Jericho and Ai, and the five kings of the Amorites are worried because Gibeon has made alliances with Israel. And so they gather themselves together and they're going to go attack Gibeon. And Gibeon calls out to Joshua and the Israelites, hey, come save us. You know, we're in trouble. So Joshua has to rush his whole army all through the night about from Gilgal to Gibeon, a distance of about 20 miles, to crush the five kings. And he gets there and he wins the battle, but they're scattering and there's a lot of them. And Joshua needs to get them all taken care of before they get back to their fortified cities and become more of a problem later on. So what does he do? He asks God to stop the sun. Then Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, sun stand still over Gibeon and moon in the valley of Ajalon. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped till the people had revenge upon their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. And there has been no day like that before it or after it that the Lord heeded the voice of a man, but the Lord forgot. Lord fought for Israel. Essentially what he was asking for, although he didn't know it, was for the sun to stand still. The earth had to stop spinning. So, you know, how amazing this is. If you ask any physicist, any scientist, go to any of them, what would happen if the earth suddenly stopped spinning? You would be inundated with a multitude of different catastrophic disasters that would essentially wipe out civilization. Because the earth, if you think about it, the earth is spinning at about 1,000 miles per hour. And everything on the earth is spinning at 1,000 miles per hour, including all the water in the oceans, all the dirt, the rock, and the air. It's all spinning around. And I don't know if any of you have ever done this, but when I was little, we used to have this swimming pool, you know, one of those little portable ones. And one of my favorite things to do was you start running around or start swimming around in a circle, getting that water going into like a mini whirlpool. And then what you do, when it got fast enough, you turn around and try and swim against it. And the force of that momentum would just knock you over. That was, for some reason, fun. But that's what would happen with all that water. So, and on top of that, if you think about the mass of the earth. Let's see one word here. What's the mass of the earth? 5.9 times 10 to the 24th. Kilograms. That's a big number. That's 5.9 quadrillion kilograms. 24 zeros. The amount of energy required to stop that from turning is unfathomable. There's no way that human beings could ever do it. This stuff, stopping the earth, the disaster that would happen from spinning the earth and the energy it would take, is impossible. It's physically impossible. But not for God. Can you imagine just how it would be? Dear Lord, Can you please, we need more time to defeat our enemies. Can you please stop the sun, the sky? Was that Joshua? Well, you need more time. Let me just stop the earth from spinning. You need a whole day? No problem. But Lord, won't that cause catastrophic damage in all the earth? Not for me. Not for me. He is capable of anything. And, you know, a lot of people look at this because of the amount of energy it would take and the destruction it would cause, and they say, well, you know, that's why they scoff at it and they don't believe, well, it was probably figurative. You know, maybe, you know, he was just made it look, or it was an illusion. There's no way that, you know, God could do this. But there, I don't know how anybody could put God, who created everything, into a bottle like that and say, well, you can make the earth and everything out of nothing, but you can't stop the earth. It's impossible. But there is evidence. Anybody who studies ethnology, when you start looking at the stories of the flood, the stories of a catastrophic flood all over the earth, folk tales. People talk about it because it's been passed down from Noah, the story of that flood, and spread out. That's a big deal. What, the whole earth was flooded? That's spread out with everybody's cultures. That's why they're all over the place, because there was a flood. Now, if you look also at ethnology, you can find that there are stories and folk tales of a day that lasted twice the length of a normal day in several other cultures. In India, in China, they have records of this. Now, of course, people scoff at it. Well, they're folk tales, and it's nothing important. But even Herodotus, the Greek historian, back in around the 400 BC, he went to Egypt, and he looked in their records, and he recorded that they have recorded a day that lasted twice as long as a normal day. And on the other side of the world, where it wasn't day, it would have been a long night, there are records, folk tales, of a night that lasted twice as long as normal. The American Indians, the Aztecs, the Mayans, they all have stories. Even all the way over to Easter Island, there's folk tales about that extra long night. So I believe it is because it actually happened, and God has that kind of power. Let's take a look at another one. 2 Kings 20, verse 9. So, story of Hezekiah. Everybody knows this one. Hezekiah has got some kind of boil or infection. Not sure exactly what was causing it, but he was going to die. And God sent Isaiah and said, hey, guess what? Time's up. Get your affairs in order. And Hezekiah cries and he prays to God. And God says, you know, I've heard your prayers, and I'm going to extend your life. And Hezekiah asks for a sign. He says, tell me, what's the sign that this is, that you're speaking the truth? And Isaiah said, this is the sign to you from the Lord, that the Lord will do the thing which he has spoken. Shall the shadow go forward 10 degrees or go backward 10 degrees? And Hezekiah answered, it is an easy thing for the shadow to go down 10 degrees, but no, but let the shadow go backward 10 degrees. So Isaiah the prophet cried out to the Lord, and he brought the shadow 10 degrees backward, by which it had gone down on the sundial of Ahaz. So not only can he stop the earth from spinning, he can also reverse it. And that's proof positive that, you know, if anybody's seen the original Superman, when he flies around the earth backwards, the time does not go reverse, because God spun the earth backwards about 40 minutes. 10 degrees on the sundial is about 40 minutes. And nobody knew. I mean, just the shadow. They saw the shadow going back, but nobody, it was no cataclysmic earthquake, no devastation. God controlled all of it as simply as we would spin a top on the ground. And that's how powerful he is. Let's take a look at another one. Judges chapter 6. So this is a good one here for about Gideon. I like Gideon. So Israel's in trouble during the time of the judges. They are being persecuted by the Midianites now. And God sends an angel to speak to Gideon, telling him, hey, I'm going to save Israel through you. And Gideon, of course, he's always looking for signs. Several times he asks God for signs. You know, how do I know this is really going to, you're really picking me? So Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only, and it is dry on all the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. Now, I don't know where he came up with this. He just made this test up, just this impossible task for God to do, and say, Lord, if this is really you speaking to me, do this task. And God looks at him, he says, what's that? You want me to just make the fleece wet on the dry ground? Not a problem. And it was so. And he rose early next morning and squeezed the fleece together. He wrung the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water. Just to make sure that there was no doubt, like Gideon touched the fleece and said, well, maybe it's damp, maybe it's not. It's soaking wet with dew. And he wrings out a whole bowl full of water, and the ground is dry. But then Gideon says, okay, you know, I saw that, but don't be angry with me, but let me speak just once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, but on all the ground let there be dew. And God did so that night. And it was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on all the ground. So how does that happen? I have no idea. It's impossible for human beings to control the dew like that, on specific areas like that. It's impossible, but not for God. And I find it really reassuring that in all these three examples, God has all this power, this immense ability that we can't even fathom. He listens to mankind. I go keep going back to that Psalms 8. What is man that you are mindful of him? Joshua prays to God to stop the sun, and God listened. And he did what Joshua wanted. Hezekiah prayed. You know, God offered him a choice. And he said, what do you need to believe in me? And I will do it. And here Gideon asks, say, God, just please do this so I know. And God did it. Much like Thomas and Jesus. Thomas, he doubted. He didn't believe. And Jesus says, what do you need to believe? And he does it. So, let's continue now on. This is another miracle. Gideon, because we have those two requests for signs that he just did. And just earlier, he asked for another sign. When the angel first appeared to him, he says, the angel speaks to him and tells him that he's going to save Israel. And Gideon asks for another sign. He says this is the third sign he's asking about the same situation. I think it's just funny that he keeps asking. And what does the angel do? Gideon brings out broth and meat and puts it on this rock. And the angel touches the rock with a staff. And flames shoot out of a rock and consume the sacrifice. Not only can God do it with a bush, but he can do it with a rock. And there's no technology that I could think of that can cause flames to spontaneously sprout out of a plain old rock without some kind of manipulation beforehand. So, impossible? Yeah. But not for God. John 2. The wedding at Cana. Now there were set there 6 water pots of stone according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. Jesus said to them, fill the water pots with water, and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast. And they took it, and when the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, he did not know where it came from. The master of the feast called the bridegroom. Well, I don't know about you, but I have seen quite a few magicians in my time, quite a few magic tricks, and some which were pretty amazing and astounding. But every time I've seen a magic trick, I never ever thought that magician had superpowers. You know, I always knew there was a trick somehow. Like, I wonder how they did that. But with that magic trick, you know it was a trick because they control the situation. They control your viewpoint. They control like what you see and what you don't see with cloaks and stuff. They always use their own things. You know, even street magicians, you know, there's always set up beforehand. And you can see that in some of the expository, you know, clips that they show. There's always a setup. This, Jesus walks into this wedding, he's not using anything of his own, he's using their pots, their water, and he changes the water to wine without even touching it, apparently. So how is it possible that he could change water into wine? People have been trying to do this kind of thing since the beginning of time, using witchcraft, spells, alchemy, and even technology. They're trying, how do you change one thing into another? How can you change a stone into a loaf of bread? But God has that power. Not only can he can control and change the macro universe, playing with the sun, the moon, the stars, and the earth like toys, he controls the micro universe. Elements on a molecular level, he commands with a word and changes it right in front of people's eyes. It's impossible. Nobody knows how to do that. But not for God. The laws of physics don't apply to God. Let's look at Mark chapter 4. That day when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. And a furious squall came up. Furious. Some translations say a great windstorm. So it wasn't just a little, you know, drizzle. I mean, this was a life-threatening storm. The waves were crashing over the boat. And the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped, and Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" And he got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." Then the wind died down and it was completely calm. Not just settled down, completely calm. With a word. Then the wind died down and it was completely calm. And he said to his disciples, "Why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith?" And they were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him?" God can control the weather with a word, and not over days, but like that. I mean, there's no technology. I mean, I tried to look up how we could control the weather. Human beings have figured out maybe how to make it snow a little bit over certain areas, but we can't control the weather like this. How do you even control? What is there to control? I mean, there's the wind, the water, and the clouds, but what is there to control that you can change the weather like that? Nobody even knows how to start with that. It's impossible. But not for God. Now, I just want to take a look at three historical examples. I'm not going to make any allusions. I'm not going to make any credits to anything here. I'm just going to mention them. Just talk about them real quick. Just for point of reference. So in 1588, everybody who studies history knows this one, the Spanish Armada. King Philip II tried to invade England and take it over. He wanted to get rid of Queen Elizabeth for various reasons, but the main point is he was going to try and take over England, which would have changed the course of history. So he took this armada of 130 ships, and he sailed up, you know, the English Channel, going to try and pick up troops in the Netherlands to take over England. And yes, the English did attack the Spanish, and they won some battles, but what people often forget is that there was an instrumental storm that came about, a hurricane that destroyed more ships than any of the British did in their battles with the Spanish. Which kind of goes along, if you remember back in Gibeon, when the Amorites were fleeing from Joshua, God sent a storm of hailstones, and the hailstones destroyed more of the Amorites than the Israelites did. And here, this storm destroyed more of the Spanish ships, crippling their fleet, so they were not able to ever enter England. And so instrumental was that storm, so crucial, that the Queen had several coins commemorating the whole event of the defeat of the Spanish Armada, and on the outside she had inscribed the words God blew and they were scattered, indicating that God breathed out and destroyed the armada. That's how instrumental it was. Kublai Khan in 1274 and 1281, twice Kublai Khan tried to invade Japan and take it over, which of course would have changed history. And two times that whole army of hundreds of ships tried to get into Japan. They landed on a few islands. There were a few skirmishes. But both times, a typhoon whipped up out of nowhere. If you read the accounts, the history, a sudden typhoon came and destroyed both those fleets. Destroyed more of those army than any of the Japanese did when they had those little skirmishes. And crushing, not just once, but twice. And this is where the term, you know, kamikaze comes from. They think it means divine wind. They think that that storm was so powerful, so decisive, so timely that it had to be from God. That's what they think. I'm not saying that's from God. That's what their praise comes from. And just one more. The storm that saved Washington, August 24th, 1814. Of course, the War of 1812, the British invade America. And the British defeat the Americans at the Battle of Bladensburg and march into Washington, D.C. And they occupy it for about 26 hours. They burn the Capitol, and they were going to cause way more damage. But a sudden storm, a tornado, whipped up out of nowhere. Again, read the accounts. They're amazed by how instantly this tornado came out of nowhere, put out the fires, and killed more of the British than the Americans did at the Battle of Bladensburg, and effectively crushed their army, and they had to retreat and get out of Washington, D.C. So, I am not so bold as to say that these were caused by God. You know, I don't know. But I do know that how dangerous it is and controversial when people start saying, oh, this was caused by God, that was caused by God. I'm not going to say these are caused by God, because I have no idea. But I will say they are very God-like. It seems very similar to storms that have happened in the Old Testament, where God controls the weather, killing more people, more of the enemy than... Well, of course, the enemy is a relative. But it seems very God-like. And some people say, well, you can't say that's from God. You can't even assume it, because God doesn't work that way in this world anymore. And I'm not going to argue with that. But if you look in the Old Testament, and even the New Testament, you see how much God works in the world using weather, insects, disease, droughts, floods, politics, other powers. He uses all of that, and it's documented in the scripture how to control the world and lead it, aim it the way he wants things to go. And so I am to assume that after the end of the New Testament, God just threw up his hands and said, well, my job's all done. Whatever happens, happens. It's all yours. It's a little bit of a stretch for me, but again, I'm not going to argue the point. Let's look at a few more. Now, what discussion about miracles would be complete without talking about the Red Sea? Everybody knows this, Exodus 14. The Israelites are in trouble. They're pinned in by the Egyptians on one side and the Red Sea on the other, and they're about to get mowed down. So what does God do? He says, no problem. I'm just going to part the sea so that you can walk on dry land and escape. I mean, look at that picture. I mean, who controls water like that? Who can make it stand up as if it's a living thing and part the ways? Nobody has that kind of power. It's physically impossible. But not for God. God has this kind of power. And he controls the water as if it was his friend. He controls everything. There's no, the laws of physics do not apply to God. And just for anybody's reference, this movie is the Ten Commandments, which was, I think, a good movie. It wasn't perfect, but it really had an effect on me when I watched it as a kid. I still like to watch it from time to time. And just so you know, Charlton Heston played Moses, and for me, that's Moses. That's what he looks like. If he doesn't look like that when I get to heaven, I'm going to be a little bit disappointed. But that affected me a lot. Let's look at just a couple more. So the story of Elijah and the widow of Zarah. The widow of Zarah. 1 Kings 17. So this Israel is in trouble again, and God is causing a great drought in Israel. And Elijah was sent first to a brook, the Kereth Ravine, where he was fed by ravens who brought him food, which is amazing. But then when the brook dried up, he sent him to this widow at Zarah, and he's in the city, and he's talking to this, he finds this widow, he's told to go stay with her, and he asks the widow for a little bread and water, and the widow says, well, I'm sorry, all I got is some little oil, a little flour, I'm going to go make this one last meal for me and my son, and then we're going to die. So I got to hurry up and pick up these sticks, so I can't do that right now. But Elijah says to her, don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said, but first make a small loaf of bread for me and for what you have, and bring it to me. Then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the land. She went away and did as Elijah told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman and her family, for the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry, in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. How does that happen? How do you have a jar of oil and you keep pouring it and it never ends? Where is it coming from? How does that happen? Who has that kind of power? How do you get a basket with 5 loaves and 2 fishes and you keep taking out of it and it's never ending? It's physically impossible. There's no way that you can keep pouring and it just doesn't end. I don't understand how that's possible. But it's not impossible for God. He has that power. Matthew 14. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to him walking on the sea. Jesus can walk on water. Physically impossible. No human has authentically replicated that ever without using some kind of tool or some kind of device. Jesus walks on water. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, it is a ghost. And they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, be of good cheer, it is I. Do not be afraid. You know, I love this miracle because, you know, you can see God treating us all like children. We are His children. He is our Father throughout the whole Bible. But for this one really hits me home because you can see, as Nathan has said before in a sermon, Jesus is not bragging. He's not showing off. He's not skating around on the water saying, hey, look what I can do. He's telling Peter, he says, look, come on, come with me, you can do this too. And any parent who has a child knows that when you're teaching them and you have your arms around them when they're trying to take their first steps or walking or learning to ride a bike, you would do anything to protect them and keep them safe. And you tell that child, look, I've got you, I'm going to protect you, have faith, just know, you can do it, you can do it. You can do it. I can do it. You can do it. And Jesus tells us. He tells Peter, come on. Come on out. He's sharing His power with us. If you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can tell that mountain to move from here and there. It's not just for me. If you believe in God, all you need to do is believe. I mean, not just believe. There are things that go along with believing. But just in case nobody misunderstands me, and it's baptism and other things, but that's another lesson. But it starts with belief, believing that He has that power. And He's trying to take us to that next level. 1 Kings 18, Elijah on Mount Carmel, facing off against the 400 priests of Baal. Then the fire of the Lord fell a pillar of fire comes out of heaven and pinpoints this altar and consumed the burnt sacrifice and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, "The Lord, He is the God, the Lord, He is the God." What kind of power is this, that He controls fire out of heaven like that? Who can do this? Who has this kind of power? It's impossible, but not for God. Then you have the 10 plagues of Egypt. I could go on and on about this one, going through each one. How is it possible? How's that all stuff comes out of nowhere? I have no idea. Daniel 3, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These three went into a blazing inferno. Stood there. How did they breathe? With the air that was in there, it must have been... How is that possible? I would choke. If I get too close to a campfire, my eyebrows get singed. But they come out, not even their clothes smelled of smoke. It's physically impossible, but the laws of physics do not apply to God. He can do anything. Nothing is impossible. Now, a lot of people have said to me, you know, well, when I talk about these miracles, they say, well, you're glancing over some of the big ones where God raised people from the dead. Well, that's true, but I think they all can be overshadowed and eclipsed by the one resurrection that outdoes them all. Jesus raised Himself from the dead. Now, all the other resurrections that I can find, to my knowledge, involved somebody else doing the resurrection. You know, Elijah, Elisha, Paul, Jesus. They all raised somebody. It took somebody else to do something. Even somebody raised from the dead from touching Elisha's bones. But it was some interaction with somebody here on the planet that caused that resurrection. Jesus didn't need anybody. There was nobody there. They killed His body and He just came back by Himself. Who has that kind of power where life and death are like a flip of a switch? Nobody but God. And this is, to me, is proof positive that the body is not to be worried about. Anxiety and stress over what's going to happen to us, because the body is just a tool. Jesus just used this body. The Romans and the Jews killed it. But He came right back and just got a new one. They could not kill Jesus. They could only damage His body. Moses and Elijah were dead a long time. But there they were, talking with Jesus during the Transfiguration. Samuel was dead. His body was dead. But he came back up and talked with Saul. So the body is going to be disposed of, like an old shoe. But who you are lives on. And Jesus demonstrates this and shows us. So, now, I've talked about a lot of miracles. A lot of amazing things. And I hear sometimes people say, well, you know, where are the miracles today? You know, we're in trouble. You know, religion is on the ropes a little bit, because there's a lot of people in the world trying to kill us, you know, intellectually, trying to squash the morals of the Ten Commandments, of God, of what morality should be today. They're trying to get rid of us. Religion is the only thing standing in the way of what other people are trying to do in this world. It's the last thing. Because without religion, there's no real reason for any objection to any of it. So we ask a lot of people, where are the miracles? I feel like I want to see. And people say also, you know, well, there's miracles, you know, there's a trees of miracles, you know, giving birth is a miracle. And yes, but science can explain those things. They can say, you know, why a tree grows or how a baby is born. But what about the miracles that science just has no answer for? It's just impossible. We're not the only ones to have asked this question. This has been in the Bible before. Take a look back at Judges chapter 6 with Gideon. When the angel of the Lord first appears to Gideon, he says, "Hello, Gideon, the Lord is with you." What does Gideon respond? So Gideon said to him, "Oh my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites." He was looking for those miracles too. I used to think when Gideon, I read about Gideon and all his requests for signs, you know, I thought, well, maybe he's weak. But we know he wasn't weak in faith. He's listed in Hebrews 11 in the Hall of Faith. We know he was a man of faith. But I think he asked for all those signs is because he was looking for those miracles that his fathers told him about. The parting of the Red Sea, the flood, all those miracles. And he was wanting to see them for himself. And that's why he asked so many times. That's why sometimes I think we can feel a little bit like Job. Where are you, God, in this world? You know, why haven't you, where's your answer for what is happening? Why don't you show these people who you are and your power? Let us see those miracles again. So, one last miracle, and then we'll be done. Mark chapter 5, verse 21. When Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was at the lake. And one of the synagogue leaders, a synagogue leader, a ruler, it says in several other places, named Jairus, came. And when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. A synagogue leader, I can assume, is not somebody who's accustomed to falling on his feet, falling on anybody's feet and begging for anything. So he knew his daughter was dying. He knew this was the last chance. Because we find out in a few other verses that she dies shortly after this. So this was dire for him. He knew that he needed Jesus. And he pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. Now a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years and had suffered many things from many physicians. She had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. And when she heard about Jesus, she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment, for she said, "If only I may touch his clothes, I shall be made well." And immediately the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the affliction. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" But his disciples said to him, "You see the multitude thronging around you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see her who had done this thing. But the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." Another impossible miracle, not for Jesus. While he was still speaking, some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" As soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not be afraid, only believe." Now I deliberately took the time to read through that whole section there to give you a kind of sense of how long Jairus was waiting for Jesus to come save his daughter. Imagine if one of your children was dying at home, just a little ways away, and you know the answer, the Savior who can heal her, is right there. But he's waiting, he's tarrying with this woman who's afflicted. But in his mind, do you not think he was begging, "Jesus, come on, I'm in trouble here, my daughter is dying"? And do you think Jesus knew? We know several times in the Bible that Jesus knows what people are thinking. Do you think he would not know that Jairus was dying inside, waiting for Jesus to do his miracle? "Jesus, please, just do this. We need this right now." But Jesus is on a whole nother level. Death is insignificant. Not insignificant, but it's inconsequential, because he knows that she's going to be alive. It's just a matter of flipping the switch. He knows everything is going to be right. Once, if he only believes and puts faith in him, that his daughter is going to be just fine. And they'll be laughing and playing the next day. it's not as dire. But he needed Jairus to see this miracle. He needed Jairus to wait to see that it was Jesus who was healing this other person. And that when after the daughter dies, he can see the power that Jesus has and believe. And of course, what does Jesus do? He goes and he heals the daughter. She's not dead. She's just asleep. What was so permanent and devastating to Jairus was completely reversed in a second. He raised the daughter from the dead, and she was fine. Now, the nearest equivalent, I've been looking and looking, the nearest human equivalent I can find of this is a little silly, but it's Willy Wonka. If you ever watch the movie Willy Wonka, there's this part where he goes on this thing called the Wonka-mobile, and the only people he's got left is Charlie, his uncle Joe, Mrs. TV, and Mike TV. And they all get on this Wonka-mobile, and he starts it up, and he starts driving down the road, a little bit of a pathway there. And it's filled with all these carbonated beverages. And as soon as they start going, it starts frothing and spewing all this sticky foam everywhere. And Mrs. TV, who's in the front, she's getting blasted by all this stuff, and she's freaking out. She's saying, "Oh, my hair, my makeup, my clothes, oh, it's a disaster. It's horrible. Why is this happening?" And Willy Wonka, what's he doing? He's singing up at the top, driving the machine. Not a care in the world. And why? Because he's on a completely different level. All those cares and anxieties that Mrs. TV had about her clothes, her makeup, you know, her face, her hair. Insignificant. It doesn't matter in the big picture. Because Willy Wonka knows that in a few short feet they're going to pass through that little scrubbing machine and it's all going to be gone. It's all going to be fixed. That's why he's singing. Now I know this is a very pale comparison to what Jesus is, but I'm trying to bring it down to our level. Jesus is so far above us when he thinks about the power that he wields. How in control of everything that he is, that it's sometimes hard for us that are confined on this world to actually conceptualize and believe in things that are so beyond our capabilities. But it's there for us to believe. And he did it for us to believe. John chapter 20, verse 30. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you may have life in his name. So I leave you with the same words that Mark 5, that Jesus said to Jairus. No matter what happens, no matter what travesties, what calamities happen, if we put our faith in God, he will help us. Do not be afraid. Only believe. So if there's anybody here who wants to believe in Jesus, who needs to believe in God, and needs to be saved and washed in Jesus' blood, there are several here who are able to talk to you if you want to come forward as we stand and sing.